On this episode of Risk, you'll hear...
You're being charged with attempted murder.
And you'll hear...
Charlie Brown, come on, get your treat!
And me, Kevin Allison. On the show where people tell true stories they never thought they'd dare to share.
Ready to launch your business? Get started with the commerce platform made for entrepreneurs. Shopify is specially designed to help you start, run, and grow your business with easy, customizable themes that let you build your brand, marketing tools that get your products out there, integrated shipping solutions that actually save you time. From startups to scale-ups, online, in person, and on the go, Shopify is made for entrepreneurs like you.
Sign up for your $1 a month trial at shopify.com/setup.
Illumination presents Minions and Monsters.
You want to make a monster movie?
Si, con pica kaiju.
And what are you going to use for your monster?
On July 1st.
I know the perfect monster for your movie.
Just try not to look too delicious.
Quick question. I want to eat one of these funny looking yellow guys. Is that okay?
Minions and Monsters in cinemas Wednesday, July 1. Book tickets now.
Busy routines can make it hard to focus on your health goals, but MedExpress offers a simple way to explore weight management treatment online. Complete our short eligibility consultation with no need for face-to-face appointments or travel. If eligible, treatment is delivered discreetly, with UK-registered clinicians offering support along the way. Visit medexpress.co.uk/podcast to get started today.
Welcome to the I Can't Sleep podcast with Benjamin Boster. If you're tired of sleepless nights, you'll love the I Can't Sleep podcast. I help quiet your mind by reading random articles from across the web to bore you to sleep with my soothing voice. Each episode provides enough interesting content to hold your attention, and then your mind lets you drift off. Find it wherever you get your podcasts. That's I Can't Sleep with Benjamin Boster.
Folks, this is Simon Osterhold behind me now, and this is an episode we're calling Something Wild. I've been away for a little bit, and boy, will I have something wild to talk about soon. But let's get to the stories. We're going to start with a favorite of ours, Cambry Cruz, who told this one in March of 2025 at our friend Julia Wiedemann's show in New York called Top Shelf Stories. It's a story we call Horsin' Around.
I grew up in a deaf family. My mom is deaf, my dad is deaf, my aunts, my uncles, my grandparents, almost everyone in my immediate family is deaf, and this prompts a lot of questions. So I'm going to answer the top three FAQs, so then we can just move on. One, yes, I know sign language. Two, I know how to talk because I'm not deaf. I can hear and I can talk. And no, I cannot read Braille. thank you for the ASMR menu thing, but no, I do not know how to read Braille. Not a question, but a frequent comment is, oh my goodness, your whole family's deaf, even your mama? Oh, bless your heart. I'm like, bless my heart? I said they were deaf, not dead. Okay, you're a kid. Your parents cannot hear what you're doing. what's the downside? I'm trying to find one because, yeah, we could listen to music as loud as we wanted, as late into the night as we wanted, to whatever kind of music we wanted. I had a Columbia Records, like 10 cassettes for a penny, and I got Richard Pryor, Eddie Murphy, George Carlin, and my parents would be like, what's so funny? And I'm like, ah, just a funny man, a comedian. Okay. I was 8. And I had debt, too. Columbia Records was like, Cambry Cruz, pay up. And I'm like, I have no money. I'm sneaking out of the house, walking out the front door. Sneaking back in, just as easy. As long as we didn't shake the trailer. Our trailer was up on stilts, which created vibrations, which my parents are sensitive to. So we would just tiptoe through the front door. Bye, Mom! Bye, Dad! And tiptoe back. Now, besides my family being deaf, my parents being deaf, they also worked very, very long hours over time. We were pretty poor, so they were trying to rake in the money, and we lived in the deep, deep, deep woods of Texas, like rural, rural Texas. No running water, no electricity, no plumbing for a hot minute. And they would drive an hour and a half to Houston, sometimes more with traffic, and back. So we were left on our own for long stretches of time, which meant that our trailer was the place to hang out. And in summertime, basically, it devolved into like a Southern fried Lord of the Flies. It was every kid for himself, kill or be killed. My older brother, Kevin, was almost 5 years, 4.5 years older than me. And he and his friends, they would get high, and they would be like Tom Sawyer or whatever, hunting snakes and skinning snakes. We had just snake skins everywhere. I, on the other hand, I wrote and produced puppet shows, and I turned my bedroom into a fully functional library, complete with a Dewey Decimal System. I had customers and late fees, and I earned money. I was a little entrepreneur. Now, the summer I turned 13, things changed. My brother and his friends, they're now like 18, 20, 21. They're all sitting in the living room getting high as usual. And, you know, they would always ask me if I wanted some pot, and I'd be like, no, I'm doing inventory. But this time, I walk in, and there's a girl sitting on the couch with them. There were no girls in Montgomery, Texas. And she was my age, 13, and she's sitting on the couch with them, getting high. So when she asked me if I wanted a hit off the joint, I said, sure, yeah, okay. So I take a hit. We get high, and after a bit, we get the munchies. So we're like, yeah, what are we going to do? We're poor. We don't have any food in the house. Like, we got some potatoes in the garden. She's like, oh, well, let's just go to Webb's Grocery. I'm like, Webb's Grocery? That's 4 miles one direction. How are we going to get there? And she's like, oh, my horse, doy. What the? A horse? There's a horse in our yard. And his name is Star, and he's like freedom from this trailer and being isolated in the woods. And so we hop on the back of Star. He's a tiny little Arabian horse. And we ride 4 miles to Webb's Grocery in the hot summer sun. And it was great. And along the way, she hands me a cigarette, asks me if I want to smoke. Yes, of course. And I get, you know, like the buzz. And then we get to Webb's Grocery, and I buy a pack of cigarettes and a bottle of Boone's Farm. Now, Mr. Webb had been selling me packs of Coors Light and Cools for my dad while he sat in the Chevy pickup truck. I don't know why it didn't dawn on him that maybe a grown man would not switch brands of cigarettes and Boone's Farm, Strawberry Hill. But he gave them to me. Have a good day, kid. You got it, mister. Get back on Star, ride 4 miles back to the trailer. We did this every day, all summer long. After a while, Maria's dad was like, Cambry, you're breaking this little horse's back. She's a pint-sized little Joan Jett look-alike. I'm, you know, a big girl. And the two of us on this little horse, he's like, Cambry, you got to get a horse of your own. I'm like, that's a great idea. I'm going to ask my parents. So I pitch it to my parents. I'm like, I'm a straight-A student. I have never been in trouble, and I have two jobs. I was a busboy at a yacht club, and I ran and managed a fireworks stand on the side of the road by myself, 13, while I smoked with two fucking tons of explosives and money, and yet I survived. Here I am. Here we are. So my brother, on the other hand, never had a job, flunked out of sixth grade, and he was kicked off the bus for fighting. And yet he still got a shotgun and a waterbed for Christmas. That is not fair. I am a feminist and I demand equal pay. And they were like, you know what? You're right. So I get a horse. And if, when people hear this part of the story, they're like, whoa, wait, you weren't poor. You had a horse. I'm like, you're thinking Hamptons riding crops and steeplechases. No. Think like Ecuador or Peru. You can like find a horse, tie it up to a tree. Voila, you have a horse. They are there to fertilize our garden, keep the ground clear, and take me to get some Boone's Farm Strawberry Hill. Now, Charlie Brown was his name, and he was so smart. My mom said he thought he was one of us, and he would follow me around like a puppy dog. If I walked, he walked. If I jogged, he trotted. If I ran, he galloped. And I swear, he was stuck to me, forgive me, like glue. Just with me forever. So when one day I couldn't find Charlie Brown, I thought that was a little odd. I go out there and I ring this bell that he knew when I rang it, he got a special treat. Ring the bell, Charlie Brown, come on, get your treat. Come on, we got to go to Webb's Grocery. Mama needs some Boone's Farm. Ringing the bell, nothing. And then finally I see him on the perimeter of the land, but he's bucking. He's like, just bucking, and his hair's whipping around. He's shaking his head. And I'm like, oh my God, I think a swarm of wasps or bees is around him because he's trying to buck something off or shake something off. But he didn't look distressed. He didn't look agitated. He just was doing this weird bucking, and he was just going around in circles on the perimeter of the property over and over. And I kept calling and ringing the bell. Nothing. Charlie Brown screaming. Finally, I go inside. Asked my mom and brother, they're sitting on the couch watching television. I said, Mama, something's wrong with the horse. Come look. She's like, what's wrong? I was like, I don't know. Come on. And she and my brother come out there. And I'm like, look, you're going to see him. He looks like he's in slow motion. It was really actually quite beautiful, if it weren't so weird. He's like bucking and shaking. She goes, oh, that is so strange. It's like he's high or something. And that's when my brother tears off barefoot through the woods behind our shed and lets out a blood-curdling scream. Fuck! Comes stomping back. He ate my plants. We're like, what? My pot. He ate it all. We're like, what are you talking about? My brother had been growing giant stalks of marijuana behind the shed, and Charlie Brown had found it and chomped off the tops of each and every one. Charlie Brown was baked. He was baked. So if you ever want to know what a high horse looks like when you are told to get off one, that's what they look like. Thank you very much. That's my story.
What happens when two people who grew up in a very strange corner of Los Angeles look back and realize just how bizarre their upbringings really were?
They start a podcast, of course.
I'm Ashley Johnson.
And I'm Taliesin Jaffe. Before we became the internet people we are today, we spent our childhoods as working actors, appearing in shows like Growing Pains and films like Mr. Mom.
In our podcast, Weird Kids, we're diving deep into our unique upbringings, our friendship with each other, and all the delightfully odd interests we still carry with us today.
In each episode, we get to share stories of our youth, the things that bring us joy, the problems that we face, and occasionally, the friends we've collected along the way.
If you're a misfit, an outcast, or just a weirdo who loves all things nostalgic and unconventional, come take a seat at our table.
Each week, we'll be releasing previously members-only episodes on YouTube and all major podcast platforms, with new episodes dropping exclusively and ad-free on Beacon.tv.
I'm Jonathan Goldstein, and this spring, Heavyweight revisits some favorite episodes. Yeah, I think I want to know why she made my life so difficult, if she had some kind of thing against me.
Plus, we check back in with our guests to see what's changed in the years since.
How long has it been?
Things have transpired.
Yeah, the last 10 years. Everything's changed.
New updates begin March 12th. Listen to Heavyweight wherever you get your podcasts.
Hey, do you have trouble sleeping? Then maybe you should check out The Sleepy Podcast. It's a show where I read old books in the public domain to help you get to sleep. It was the best of times. It was the worst of times. It was the age of wisdom. Classic stories like A Tale of Two Cities, Pride and Prejudice, Winnie the Pooh. Stories that are great for kids and adults alike. So whether you have a tough time snoozing or just like a good bedtime story, fluff up the cool side of your pillow and tune in to Sleepy. Unless you're driving, then please don't listen to Sleepy. Find Sleepy wherever you get your podcasts. New episodes every Sunday. Sweet dreams.
This is Risk. This is Prophecy Playground behind me now. And we just heard from Cambry Cruz, the founder of QED, the beloved performance venue in Astoria, Queens. And she's also the author of the critically acclaimed best-selling memoir, Burn Down the Ground. Look her up on Instagram at Cambry Cruz. Folks, my next online storytelling workshop starts on June 28th. It'll be Sunday mornings at 10 a.m. Eastern Time. If you're thinking, I'm too shy, I don't have stories, that seems too complicated or too intense, no, it's fun, with tons of flexibility for people of all levels of experience, people who want to tell various kinds of stories, and such a wonderfully supportive vibe that we create. So email me at kevin@risk-show.com to get on in. And folks, Risk is so expensive to run that several of our staff members, including yours truly, have gone without paychecks of any kind, of any amount now, for months. People are dipping into their savings to keep this show running now. I cannot emphasize enough how much we truly need the support of our listeners at patreon.com/risk, or you can make a one-time donation at paypal.me/riskshow. Now, our next story comes from Evan Miles. It's Evan's first time on the show. This is one of those stories about someone in a relationship they should have gotten out of earlier. It's called Reasons to Stay.
It's December 21st, 2022. It's a winter solstice. Shortest day of the year, but the longest night of my life. I'm driving home after working a 12-hour shift at the hospital, still in my scrubs. I try calling my partner. No answer. I send a text. Nothing. But I don't think much of it, because we've been texting all day, doing normal couple stuff. Processing a return at West Elm. A group text with friends talking about our holiday plans. We were scheduled to fly out the next day to visit her parents for Christmas, right after my shift. And that morning, before work, I kissed her goodbye. Now, the truth is, we had had a catastrophic fight 9 days earlier. The kind where you don't know if a relationship is going to survive it. But afterward,
It really felt like we turned a corner. I mean, we've been talking every day since that fight, making plans. I mean, we just signed a contract to build a mother-in-law suite in our backyard. So yeah, that day felt normal. So anyways, I'm driving home on the phone with this friend, talking to him about that fight, trying to make sense of it. I'm about a mile from my house when I hear it. Doof, 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 doof. A helicopter. I don't think anything of it. But I'm looking around at the street, the houses, telling my friend, holy shit, something's happening in my neighborhood. And this searchlight is sweeping back and forth across the road, the parked cars, the windows. And as I look up through my moonroof, the helicopter is right above me. And the light drops straight down onto my windshield. And that's when it hits me. This is for me. And before I can react, four police cruisers surround me. Two in front, two behind, doors fly open, guns come out. Face down on the asphalt, cold seeping through my scrubs, my hospital badge still clipped on, my cheek pressed against the street. My heart is pounding so hard, I can barely feel the rest of my body. And the strangest thought runs through my mind. I'm supposed to be at work tomorrow. But something else in me shifts. I realize I'm in a system now. And the only thing to do is follow instructions. I don't move. My hands are behind my back. I don't talk. And while they push me against the cruiser, I have this quiet, terrifying thought.
She did this.
Because nothing else fit. Something's already happening. And all I can think is,
what did you tell them to make them show up like this?
Now, they don't explain anything. I'm handcuffed, put in a car, taken to a station, chained to a bench, waiting, staring at the floor. I focus on my breath, in through my nose, out through my mouth. Because it's the only thing I can do. And I keep telling myself, this is a mistake. Someone's gonna walk in, apologize, release me, and I'm gonna go home. Instead, I'm taken to an interrogation room. A detective sits across from me, reads me my Miranda rights, and I'm completely confused. And I ask, quietly, if I should have a lawyer. And he says,
you don't ask, you invoke.
Okay, I'd like an attorney. All right, interview's over. So they take me to booking, hand me a pair of oversized blue jail scrubs. Tell me to change. And that's when it starts to sink in. I'm not going home. I'm staying here. And weirdly, I'm still thinking about work. A deputy with this cold, vacant look says to me,
you're being charged with attempted murder.
I don't move. And just like that, everything I had built was on the line. I'm asking myself, how did I get here? So here's what I couldn't see back then. I was in a 9-year relationship with someone struggling with addiction. Alcohol at first, drug use at the end. And I couldn't see it. Or maybe I didn't want to. Because honestly, I was addicted to her, to our life. There were the promises to quit. You know, she'd go to Alcoholics Anonymous. I'd go to Al-Anon. Therapy. By the end, we had 5 therapists. And sometimes things got better. You know, she'd stop drinking and I'd feel hopeful again. But then it would start back up. Just half a glass. I want to check in with myself. And I already knew how that story ended. There are the nights I woke up to her screaming in pain from her alcohol-induced migraines. Or we'd be out with friends, laughing, and then she'd turn to me and say, "Don't fucking touch me." And the table would go quiet. And I'd smile, apologize,
try to smooth it over.
And every time it happened, I stayed silent. Told myself it was fine. Nothing ever changed. But 9 days before the arrest, something broke. And it wasn't just alcohol that night. There was a drug and a needle. So months earlier, I came home and found her on our bed, naked, glass-eyed, a syringe beside her, blood trailing down her arm, one of our cats licking it off the floor. And I remember thinking, I can't believe this is my life. I felt scared, helpless, and this deep, visceral grief. And something in me just started to shut down. And it wasn't the last time. You know, there were other nights like that. And each time I recorded it and would text it to her. Not to threaten her, but because I needed her to see what I was seeing. And so, 9 days before the arrest, I walk into the living room and it's happening again. Needle, blood, bottle of wine. And when I confront her, she denies it. And she had never lied to me before. And something in me cracked. Not just because she was using, but because for the first time, I saw clearly how long I had been explaining this away. I wasn't just loving her. I was managing it, containing it. And suddenly I saw it. What I thought was devotion was actually complicity. I was overwhelmed. Grief, anger, fear. Like every nerve ending was exposed. And all I could say was, I need to go to bed. I have work tomorrow. She was high. She was drunk. And she followed me. And this was the pattern. You know, whenever I reached my limit and tried to disengage, she wouldn't allow it. Room to room, door to door, talking, but not really talking, her words looping, losing her train of thought, starting again. And I would say, I can't do this right now. And she would say, no, we have to. But there was nothing to resolve. And I could feel it in my body, my chest tightening, my thoughts scrambling. Like I couldn't exhale. And all I wanted was space. But it kept escalating. And everything just unraveled. So in the 9 days after that night, it never crossed my mind that she was planning something else. Something designed to blow up our life. And by the time I understood what was happening, I was already arrested and sitting at the police station, silent. Booked, processed, transported. And 2 days later, still in custody, I'm transported to my arraignment in blue jail scrubs. My wrists and ankles shackled, me cuffed to another inmate. And that's when I finally get to hear the story she told them. She said I punched her. She said I attacked her. She said I injected her with a drug and left her there. And I remember standing there thinking, how do you even begin to respond to something like that? But an arraignment isn't where you get to explain yourself. You know, it's where you listen to the version of you the state has decided to believe. And that story set my bail at $1 million. But I did have something. I had a recording from that night. An account of what happened inside our home And this was just a continuation of what was going on in the months past, where I would come home, catch her in a compromising position, because I had no other recourse. I just felt like all I could do was record it and then send it to her as a text. So the video shows me in the bedroom and her in the living room. She appears visibly intoxicated, altered. But at my arraignment, I didn't even have a defense attorney yet. I was appointed a public defender. In fact, I couldn't reach anyone on the outside for 4 days because my phone had been taken. And no one was asking for my version. So after court, I'm sent back to jail. And then I land at the Twin Towers Correctional Facility. And if you've never been inside jail, especially one with a reputation like Twin Towers, it is pure chaos. You're moved from one holding area to another, rooms packed with 50, sometimes 100 men, and the noise never stops. People shouting, arguing, cursing at each other across the room. Rows of toilets lined up against the wall, no stalls, no privacy. And the smell, it hits you immediately. Sweat, bodies, and this strange burnt scent, like smoke, that they use to try to cover it up. And everyone is looking at you because you're the new guy. The first time they marched us into the group shower, I had to strip naked in front of a room full of strangers. No curtain, no stall, just concrete and running water. And I kept my eyes on the floor. But I could feel them looking at me. And you realize very quickly, you are not safe in there. One night, in the cell block next to mine, an inmate tries to hang himself. Another time I watch an inmate stab another in the lower back with a pencil, like it was nothing. 9 days total, 8 nights inside. Concrete floors, fluorescent lights that never turn off, learning to sleep, sitting up. And that's when I understood what it means to not feel safe in your own body. Eventually, my family and friends helped me get out. But getting out doesn't mean it's over. The nightmare was just beginning. Suddenly, I'm under 3 investigations at the same time. Criminal, licensing, and civil. Licensing because I'm a licensed provider, and so the Attorney General has to get involved to assess my risk to the public safety. And then a civil investigation because not only is she dissolving our relationship, but she's suing me for damages. 8 months. Court dates, metal detectors, benches and hallways, my name called again and again, like a case moving through the system, the same way my patients move through the hospital. And at work, no one knew. I still showed up, still took care of patients. During cases, my phone would light up with texts from my lawyers, documents, deadlines. Banished from my own home, I'm staying at a friend's guest house in their backyard, hiding. Because if she was willing to do this, I didn't know what else she was capable of. So of course I hid. I stopped making plans, stopped thinking more than an hour ahead. Anything beyond that felt completely overwhelming. And all I could do was hand over the details of my life to my attorneys and wait. And that waiting was its own kind of torture. Because she wasn't just an accuser. She was my life partner. And I'm struggling to grapple with the reality that the person I tried to save all these years is trying to destroy me. So for 8 months, I waited. And eventually, the case was dismissed. No apology, no acknowledgement. She walked away, and I was left with the aftermath. But the most tragic part of this story isn't the arrest. It isn't the accusation. It isn't the money. And it isn't even her betrayal. The most tragic part is that we'll never have a chance to reconcile. Because whatever happened between us, whatever love we shared, whatever mistakes we both made, that conversation will never happen. And that's hard to sit with. Because for 9 years, she wasn't just my partner. She was my home. And now, that entire chapter of my life ends in silence.
Risk. This is Tio Laza behind me now, and we just heard from Evan Miles. Now, Evan came to storytelling as one way to process what he lived through. You know, a lot of storytelling is trying to make sense out of your experiences. So his work often touches on the parts of life that only start to make sense later. You can reach Evan at griefandgrace@gmail.com. Or, of course, you can leave a comment on any of our social media at Risk Show or on the page of our website for this episode. There's a link to that in the show notes. And don't forget, my next online storytelling workshop starts on Sunday, June 28th. At 10 a.m., people jokingly call those Sunday morning workshops church with Kevin, where it's a much, much, much more fun kind of church. So even if you can't do that one, email me at kevin@risk-show.com to be kept in the loop about all the future ones. Folks, today's the day. Take a risk.
Depart in 5 minutes from platform 15. Your ride comes with 6 toilets and a refreshments carriage that you'll empty within 5 minutes. Thank you for booking your tickets on Uber.
Trains on Uber.